From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a conundrum for Michigan's cannabis retailers. Where to deposit when traditional banks won't take your cash?
We don't want people walking into Treasury to pay their state taxes to Treasury U banks with big bags.
Also, Detroit City Council decides to pump the brakes on sales of recreational cannabis. We'll hear what NIMBY ordinances in adjacent towns have meant for the industry, and some fascinating data on how some counties in Michigan profit when foreclosed homes are sold. Sometimes those sales net the county a lot of money, more even than homeowners needed to pay.
Whether they owe $1 or $10,000, if their house is foreclosed, they lose 100% of their equity.
Should the county be able to keep those proceeds to cover other costs? Those stories and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Should Michigan counties be allowed to profit from tax foreclosed homes? That's in question in a case before the Michigan Supreme Court. On the show today, we're going to take a look at the tax foreclosure system in Michigan. But first, across the globe, dams hurt native fish by blocking their access to rivers. But dams also block invasive species. A first-of-its-kind barrier designed to sort fish is being installed on the Boardman River in downtown Traverse City. If it's successful, it could be a model for rivers all over the world. Interlochen Public Radio's Kay LaFond has more.
Frank Dettori stands on the Union Street Dam in downtown Traverse City, Michigan. He's the director of public works for the city, and he says they didn't always know what they were going to do with the aging structure.
Water's seeping, weeping through it in places. It needs to be replaced.
Union Street Dam is the last remaining dam on the Boardman River. Three others have been removed as part of Michigan's largest ever river reconnection project. Local governments, state and federal agencies, and the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians teamed up to take dams out so native fish could swim freely up and down. But the Union Street Dam can't just be removed. It's blocking native fish, sure, but it's also the only thing separating the Boardman from invasive fish downstream in Lake Michigan.
We kept looking for ways to modify or understand how this could be modified to allow movement of fish up and downstream while keeping out the fish we didn't, you know, want.
One of those fish is the dreaded sea lamprey. It's actually more like an eel than a fish. Lampreys latch onto other fish and suck their blood. Native to the Atlantic Ocean, they're devastating to the fish of the Great Lakes, who often die from sea lamprey injuries. Mark Gaydon is with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, the international group in charge of controlling sea lampreys. He says figuring out how to let some fish access rivers while blocking others is the biggest fisheries management challenge of our time.
And that applies not just in the Great Lakes, but it also applies to big river systems like the Columbia River or the Mekong River or the Amazon or any other river system where you have big structures that are inhibiting fish movement.
In fact, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission was looking for a place to test fish sorting technology. Just about the time Traverse City and its partners were looking for a solution for the last dam on the Boardman. And that's how the Fish Pass Project came to be. It's a new barrier to replace the Union Street Dam, and downstream of that barrier will be a 30-foot-wide concrete research channel. And there, for the next 10 years, scientists will test ways to let some fish through the channel while holding others back. To be clear, the upstream barrier will be closed completely during this 10-year time period, so a failed experiment won't accidentally send harmful fish up the river. But the barrier can eventually be opened if a solution is found. The technologies will be tested alone and in combination and range from the advanced, like using facial recognition on the fish, to the more simple, like using lights or changing the speed of the water in the channel. Dan Zielinski, an engineer with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, says a lot of this stuff has been tried in the lab, but it's important to test it on an actual river.
So this is really the first opportunity where we can look at combining all these technologies that have been under research over the last 50 years by the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and, you know, over 100 years of research on just fish passage in general.
Zielinski says technology that can pass even a small number of fish while blocking others will be considered a success, and useful throughout the Great Lakes Basin.
You know, if you're only passing, you know, say 10% of the native fish at this site, but you're able to pass 10% of native fish at all those tributaries where you had zero, you know, that's a pretty monumental improvement.
Some Traverse City residents have concerns. Perhaps one of their largest is not the Fish Pass project itself, but which fish will eventually be allowed to pass. That decision rests with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources and the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa. Now, nobody's going to start passing sea lamprey, but there's a big question mark over some introduced sport fishing species.
I've been fishing steelhead for 51 years. I know something about it. I do not want them in the Boardman River.
That's Gary Merrick of the Brook Trout Coalition. His organization is against passing any fish that could compete with the Boardman's resident brook trout population, like introduced salmon or steelhead. The tribe has said no. They want passage for native species only. The DNR says they'll make a decision after the testing phase.
Well, I think our biggest concern is that their decision has already been made and it's just being held for implementation until the research is done.
And that's Tom White, also of the Brook Trout Coalition. He and others are worried the DNR is just biding its time. The DNR, for its part, maintains that it will wait until after the research is done and discuss the decision with affected parties. Frank Dettori, Traverse City's Director of Public Works, is excited about Fish Pass, but he's got a positive spin even on its opponents.
I think people just really care about it. And that's shown in the folks that show up, whether they're pro or con. They care about the river, and that right there is an amazing thing.
Kayla Fond reporting. That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. This morning, Detroit City Council voted to punt a decision on regulating and allowing recreational marijuana businesses in the city was pushed back until March. This is the second delay of its kind. Concerns have been raised about how the opening of the new market might be engineered to help populations who've been disproportionately affected by drug laws. Larry Gabriel writes the Higher Ground column for the Detroit Metro Times, and he also writes for the monthly Michigan Cannabis Industries Report, and he's with us on Stateside today. Larry, welcome.
Hi.
Detroit has medical marijuana dispensaries already, and they've been the source of some community concerns and pushback. The city's been dragging its heels on figuring out when, how, and where to allow recreational marijuana businesses in. What exactly is the conundrum over legal recreational cannabis in Detroit?
Well, City Councilman James Tate, he told me that the delay is that they're trying to figure out a social equity program that works for Detroiters based upon the state rules. And so that's what they came out and said today when they, you know, extended the opt-out for another month. It says in their press release, it's critical that we take the necessary time now to ensure that Detroit's impending recreational marijuana industry will properly reflect the demographic of the city it's located in. It's not enough for Detroit simply hold security jobs or floor sweeping in this industry within our city. Meaningful and sustainable access for Detroiters has to be the goal. And it goes on from there, but that's the reason.
Well, after recreational cannabis was approved overwhelmingly in a statewide vote, we started to see individual communities pass so-called opt-out ordinances, which have been characterized as not in my backyard local regulations. And meanwhile, other communities have totally embraced legal cannabis shops. Do you think this is a problem for the industry to have businesses segregated into certain pockets and communities?
Well, I think it's not good for the industry to have your largest market in the entire state not participating in that industry.
Right. The city of Detroit, that's the biggest city in the state.
I mean, think in terms of Illinois just legalized. When you think about Illinois, can you imagine Illinois legalizing and Chicago not participating?
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
Right. Michigan's journey with medical cannabis began a decade ago. Now we're in a situation where we have legal recreational cannabis shops.
Where do you think this industry could possibly be in another decade?
You know what? In another decade, it will be as different from now as now is different from a decade behind us. The change has been very fast. You know, when the law first passed, the state pretty much refused to recognize the law. The Attorney General, Bill Schuette, he got all of these county prosecutors together and they came up with a plan to fight it. And so it's been a struggle all along, and it's going to continue to be a struggle because, as you can see, in Detroit, we don't have any recreational adult use stores. But I feel like that's where it's going to be. There's going to be more acceptance along the way. And probably, you know, people will be more accommodating to that. But, you know, it'll be approximately equal to the difference we see already.
You know, to be fair, we should say that Detroit leaders have said it's not that this isn't going to happen. It's that we want it to happen right. Do you have much of a sense of how much heat and light is being expended behind the scenes to bring this along?
I don't have that sense. I talked to Councilman Tate, and he doesn't tell me that sort of thing. But, you know, there was a lot of resistance to marijuana in Detroit. A lot of community groups stood up against it. A lot of ministers, church ministers, stood up against it. And it's the law. And so they're coming along with the law. But I feel like they dragged their feet so long that the industry got ahead of them. And that was very obvious in the medical case when, you know, there was some near 200 dispensaries in Detroit. And, you know, they ended up shutting that down, and now we're somewhere around 50. I'm not exactly sure what the number is. But that's part of the issue, is because all of these places got established already. Most of them were people who had the financial wherewithal to establish those places, and now the state is only giving recreational licenses to the places that are already established, which is, you know, a pretty expensive thing to do. So now the city is trying to catch up because the industry got out ahead of them, and now they're trying to pull it back, and they're trying to, you know, make that access for, you know, Detroiters to come in. So it's going to become a legal issue. Going to become a racial issue. They're going to be fighting about it, because if you specifically see, you know, the press release when they talk about how the industry should look like Detroiters, and I would say that you have hardly any
Larry, we got to go. Larry people. Gabriel of the Detroit Metro Times.
Okay,
more on the market coming up. This is Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's era of legal cannabis sales is in full swing, with tens of millions of dollars registered for just the first few weeks. All that money, would it surprise you to know that a lot of it never goes to a bank? Cannabis is one of those industries that traditional business banks won't touch. Its profits may be legal in Michigan, but federal regulation makes handling the money very sticky. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed legislation called the Safe Banking Act to address this issue, but we wanted a little bit more grassroots reaction. The Arm of Medicine has been providing medical cannabis to customers in Ann Arbor for 10 years. It now handles sales of recreational adult use as well. Lisa Conine is the company's community outreach coordinator. Lisa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
When the business got started, did the owners realize that they wouldn't be making traditional bank deposits?
Well, it was definitely a risky endeavor just in general, but from the beginning, they worked with a bank and things were fine for a little while until they weren't fine. And then from that point on, they knew that they couldn't be honest about their business with banking, even for personal accounts and things like that. So it was always a risk right from the beginning.
So does that mean that there weren't bank deposits made after a certain point?
So there were. It was just, you know, under a different business name.
What are some of the less obvious considerations of running a business without a formal bank relationship?
The biggest issue is that public safety. So the fact that if you can't deposit your money in a normal manner, then you have cash laying around, and that puts your employees at risk and also the people that you serve. And so that's a huge issue that comes up for all cannabis businesses and how they want to navigate moving that cash around to keep people safe. And then also when it comes to paying things like your normal bills or paying taxes.
Payroll taxes, unemployment.
Exactly, yeah. So all those things just make it even harder to just operate as a normal business on top of, you know, operating a business that's still federally illegal. There's a lot of challenges that people are faced when they enter the industry. A lot of people think that, you know, the cannabis industry is just a big moneymaker, but there's actually a ton of roadblocks and a lot of challenges that people face that not a lot of people realize. It's not for the faint-hearted, that's for sure.
I heard that is transitioning to work with a bank in a little bit more transparent kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how the company came to that decision.
Yeah, so since we obtained our medical license last year, once we were licensed medically, once the whole industry started to get licensed medically, it was coming from the gray market into a license framework, then a couple of smaller banks in institutions in Michigan were willing to work with cannabis businesses. So the biggest difference there is that we're able to be honest with them about our business and what we do. And as long as we pay extra fees, then they'll go through the rigmarole that might be required there. But before that, it wasn't really the case.
I feel like people saw those lines in December when adult use recreational cannabis first became a thing and just assumed that it was a new way to print money.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely exciting. All the people that are wanting to try out cannabis and how the industry is growing, but there's still a ton of issues that the industry faces, again, including the banking issue and also a lesser known issue is the tax code 280E that cannabis businesses fall under, and so that creates a lot more challenges for operating as well.
How are cannabis businesses taxed right now in Michigan?
Yeah, so there are taxes on sales for the medical program and the adult use program, but then there's a tax code called 280E, which basically defines that if you are a business selling a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 substance, then you are not able to make normal business deductions like other businesses. So that makes it very expensive to operate and then also very tricky when you have to pay those taxes in cash because of the banking issue. So they're connected. And so, again, that's a lot of the work that we do when we're lobbying in D.C. around these two issues is trying to get these two issues resolved. So, again, cannabis businesses can operate like any other business because they're here. They're here to stay. They're already a growing industry. And so we just want to move forward and kind of clean up these issues so we can move on to the larger issues at hand.
That's crazy to think about. Are we talking about walking up to the Department of Revenue with a bag of cash?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. As I mentioned, the House of Representatives has passed a Safe Banking Act. Do you feel that the legislation there to provide at least a pathway for banks to legally deal with cannabis businesses would address the problems that has dealt with?
Most definitely. Yeah, we actually, every year myself and one of the co-founders of OHM, we go down to D.C. each year and we lobby Congress around banking reform and reform on a number of cannabis issues because of exactly what you said. It would solve a lot of issues that we face, just providing those safeguards for institutions so they don't have to fear penalty and so we can operate like any other business in the world, basically, that can just deposit their money and not have to worry about it. So that would be just a huge thing that we could get cleared up. It's a very small issue when you think about it in terms of the rest of the issues that are facing cannabis through legislation. This is a bipartisan supported issue. It's something that should be very easy to get taken care of so we can move on to other issues. And that's kind of what we're pushing for, is it's about time that we clear this up so we can look at things like descheduling, more research for cannabis, social equity, things like that.
There's something so odd about contemplating an America in which there are businesses providing cannabis for consumers, providing revenue for the state off of cannabis mm-hmm. sales. There are even some publicly traded cannabis companies now at the national level, while in other parts of the United States, there are still some people getting sent to jail for possession. Is it right for the banking piece of this to get ahead of where we are in terms of criminal law and just basic sales regulation?
Yeah, so that's really something that has been debated widely in the cannabis movement as well. And something that's really important to point out is that when we're looking at things like social equity, so individuals who have been most impacted by the war on drugs wanting to then enter the cannabis industry, if they don't have access to normal business loans, then there's no chance of opening a business. And when you can't bank normally, then you don't have that access to capital. You'd need something like a capital investor or someone to bring in money to help you start your business. And not a lot of people have access to that. And so it's something that a lot of advocates within the movement are pushing for, safe banking reform, because it can forward things like social equity and actually help people enter in, but also because, you know, there's a term called radical incrementalism. And so trying to take the wins when we can get them, but not leaving behind things like criminal justice reform. All of these advocates are also pushing for things like the MORE Act, which would completely deschedule cannabis and offer reparations for those communities on a national level. And lots of efforts are being done around expungement and also trying to legalize in all the states that are left that still have complete prohibition. So it's not one or the other. It's pushing it all together as a unified movement. And so that's something that, you know, at OHM that we're really passionate about, is supporting all of those pieces of legislation, not just something that would benefit our business alone.
Lisa, thanks for coming in and talking with us today.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Lisa Conine with the OHM of Medicine. For a deeper look at the regulatory piece of this issue, we've invited Patricia Herndon to join us, Executive Vice President for Government Relations with the Michigan Bankers Association. Patty, nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And Brian Calley is back. He's former Lieutenant Governor of the state of Michigan, now with the Small Business Association of Michigan. Brian, nice to hear from you, too.
Pleasure to be with you.
Brian, the state was on track to legalize cannabis for quite some time before last December. Why is it that we still did not have a banking structure in place when cannabis became legal?
And it's not just in Michigan. This is a nationwide issue. The main problem is with federal laws. So even when states legalize cannabis, the federal law still prohibits a lot of activities, or technically makes them illegal or keeps them illegal. And of course, banks have to follow federal law. And it's put them in a very awkward position. Customers who need banking services, the idea of having extraordinary amounts of cash and transporting it back and forth and making transactions that way, it's not ideal in any way, shape, or form. And yet that's the situation that a lot of proprietors that are operating legally under state law find themselves in.
Patty, what would you say constrains banks from working with dispensaries at this point?
Well, I think it's the fact that while we have a state law that allows it both on a medical and on a recreational level, that we still have federal law that prohibits it. And so when we look at any kind of banking of any kind of federally illegal drug, which it is still considered a Schedule I drug, when we look at that, it creates issues for bank compliance for Anti-Money Laundering and Bank Secrecy Act. So it is a rather large, rather important issue for us that we are out of compliance at the federal level when we do that.
Patty, would you say that the reticence banks feel on this issue is more due to their concerns about the regulation or more of a public perception thing?
I think it's fair for both. I think ultimately the decision whether or not they choose to bank it comes down to the regulatory piece. I think that there are also other components to the public perception. There are very few people that just don't give a darn about marijuana banking. Most people are very supportive of it or very against it. And so they think that marijuana businesses either have no place or are the best thing that ever happened. So we want to make sure that as an industry, we are not making morality decisions on who or what we bank. We believe that there should be equal access to banking of legal entities. We believe that it makes the economy and commerce system much more robust and transparent, and that we need to have something that is robust and transparent for any of our state legal entities that we're banking or choose to bank.
Is there any mechanism by which banks who do choose to work with cannabis businesses can, for lack of a better term, clean the money?
Well, it's a conundrum, because as soon as the money leaves the entity's hands, it becomes a money laundering scenario. So if I have a Herndon's dispensary and I pay my accountant to go through my things, or I pay my irrigation company, then that is money laundering at that point. We want to make sure that they have an opportunity to do so in a responsible manner. So if Bank of Herndon is banking that irrigation company, that we are aware of that and we're able to, at that point, at least have some transparency around where that money came from, and we're able to ensure then that it came from a state legal entity, not a cartel or someone else that's funding some other underground marijuana industry.
And I think this is an important distinction to keep in mind, is that we think of it in terms of you have a dispensary, the dispensary makes money and then needs to make a deposit. That's pretty straightforward. A bank would have an easy way of identifying that that a company that does this for their main source of business, they know what they are. They know what the industry code is for their customer. But what is much more complicated and still technically illegal under federal law is when a bank accepts money from an accountant, from an advertising firm, from a lawn care service, from any professional services that might be servicing a marijuana business and therefore have received money that was originated from marijuana sales.
The secondary recipients of that money.
Exactly. So the secondary recipients make the deposit in the bank. And it's not, I don't think it's very realistic. It's certainly not fair. You would expect a bank to know that deep into each of these transactions where all the cash originated from. And that's why it's important that federal law changes. At the Small Business Association, we have some of our members who are in the business directly, but we have many more members who provide services to this industry in different ways. And for all of them to have this risk, this exposure for an industry that the voters of Michigan have spoken with a very loud and forceful voice through the ballot box, they've decided to make it legal. It's an undue burden, and it's not reasonable.
As we've mentioned, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Safe Banking Act last year, but the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, has some reservations about this bill. Would either of you two have any predictions about whether or not we'll see movement on it this year?
We are hoping to see that. We've been in really regular conversations with the senator through the banking industry, both from the Michigan Bankers Association and the American Bankers Association, helping them work through some of the detail. There has been some bipartisan support in the House for that bill. It was voted out last year and had some pretty good support overall. But Senator Crapo had some concerns that were raised by some of the other amendments that were tried that folks had tried to attach to that. A lot of it having to do with the concern that policymakers have on the actual regulation of cannabis. We've shared that while these are legitimate concerns the policymakers have, we also want to ensure that the Safe Banking Act just addresses cannabis banking, that we're not trying to regulate products outside of banking in any kind of statute that would impact the banking piece. So bringing banking to this neither supports nor discourages cannabis in any of the states where people have spoken that they want it, but it does create some greater knowns around it, and it would, by the virtual transparency of it, help battle having some of those nefarious characters and cartels and others in the system.
Brian Kelly, do you see the current state of banking regulation for cannabis businesses affecting the normal growth of the industry? Is this complicating the normal cycle of consolidation that the industry might need to follow? I mean, you've written about some of the separate issues around how and whether dispensaries will let their employees interact with unions. What about the banking piece of it?
With banking in particular, this is just a core service that every single business needs. And it's difficult to imagine any scenario where you have regular and maximum growth of the industry without access to regular banking services. So I think it is absolutely a hindrance. But it's also a serious security concern as well. If you look at the way that cash money moves across the landscapes, particularly large amounts of it, you'll see it moves in armored vehicles. I mean, this is an important aspect of the security question in front of us. And to expect people that are in a business that is already in some ways, I mean, it's vulnerable, it's growing, it's brand new, and a lot of decisions that have to be made. And to put on top of that the risk to their employees that they have to transport extraordinary amounts of cash by, I mean, even what you might consider a relatively modest deposit by a lot of business standards, say $20,000 or $25,000, wouldn't be unusual for a small factory to have a deposit of that size. But if it was all in cash, think of the danger that you're putting that employee in. I think it would it would make it more difficult to attract talent into the industry, and it would also make it more difficult to manage. So there's a cost to this for sure. And really the holdup in getting this passed in the federal level, it really does seem to be a tendency toward wanting to relitigate the issue itself and not really about the banking aspect of it. And it would be best to really separate that out and say, regardless what you think of this industry, if you like it or you hate it or whatever, it would be better for the purposes of taxation and transparency and accountability and in controlling crime and security of employee. All of these things point toward legalization of the banking around the industry, at least in the states where the voters have decided to legalize it.
We've been talking with Patricia Herndon, Executive Vice President for Government Relations at the Michigan Bankers Association, and Brian Calley of the Small Business Association of Michigan. Thank you both for sharing some thoughts on this. It's a really complex topic.
It is. Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
If you fall behind on your property taxes, the county can foreclose. That has devastating consequences on many lives.
All of her equity was eliminated when the house went into tax foreclosure.
We'll look at a tax foreclosure case before the Michigan Supreme Court next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you fail to pay your property taxes, you're obviously in big trouble with the county. That can lead to a home foreclosure. Some Michigan counties routinely sell foreclosed properties and then pocket the proceeds to cover all the costs of foreclosure proceedings. But what if that sale at auction nets a lot of money? More than the foreclosure costs? More than the original tax bill plus interest? A case before the Michigan Supreme Court is testing just how much the government can take from tax-delinquent homeowners. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick filed a fascinating data story on the practice this week. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about the case before the Supreme Court?
Basically, the lawsuit was brought on behalf of a guy named Uri Rafaeli, who owned property in Oakland County, and he accidentally underpaid his property taxes 1 year by $8.41. And even though he paid his taxes in later years, Oakland County foreclosed on his home over that $8.41. Oakland County sold the home at auction for about $24,500, so they netted almost $24,500 in profit off that. And the lawsuit simply asks, is that fair, or is that an unconstitutional taking where the government took more from this property owner than they actually owed in taxes? Now, the government's argument is that essentially they can do that because there's this whole due process system in place that people have a chance over about 3 years to avoid foreclosure. And by the time that whole process is exhausted, the government isn't actually taking the property. The person is giving it up.
What does a look at the auction data tell us?
What I found were a lot of differences between the counties. Genesee County isn't making any money. They lost about $5 to $6 million a year. If you look at Wayne County and Oakland County, they are making money. They're making anywhere from a few hundred thousand dollars a year to almost in 1 year in Wayne and Oakland counties, almost $10 million a year. So there are some pretty wide differences between the counties there.
Yeah, that's not a small revenue stream.
No, it's not. It's a pretty substantial one. So yeah, those counties are making pretty good money off of selling properties at auction. And in a lot of cases, the properties relate exactly to the question at hand in this lawsuit, where some of the properties were sold for well above what the property owner owed in taxes.
So, Sarah, do the counties actually have an interest in people paying their taxes late in some cases?
Yes. The short answer is yes, because here's how the system works. Counties, in most Michigan counties, the vast majority, the county treasurer acts as the tax collector for cities when, after a year, if there are delinquent taxes, the county steps in and tries to collect those back taxes. They reimburse the cities up front out of something called the Delinquent Tax Revolving Fund. And then they set about trying to collect these back taxes. Now, the thing is that when people pay their taxes back late, the counties are allowed to charge some pretty hefty interest and fees. In fact, when I was reviewing some of the you know, the more granular data of all the properties that were foreclosed on over these 3 years in several counties, you'll find that a lot of people, like what they were actually owed in interest and fees was, in some cases, about equal to what they actually owed in back taxes. So these counties end up making pretty good revenue stream off of people actually paying their taxes late. And a lot of counties, most counties, in fact, county treasurers end up with pretty big pots of money in this delinquent tax revolving fund. And in a lot of cases, they're transferring money. In fact, nearly all the five counties I reviewed, all of them transferred some amount of money out of their revolving funds and into their county's general funds or to pay for other projects. Now, some people argue that this is a really bad way to do it because obviously it gives the county a pretty perverse incentive to, you know, have some people paying their taxes late. This is Jerry Paffendorf. He's the CEO and co-founder of Loveland Technologies, and they've been tracking the auction and foreclosure, tax foreclosure process in Wayne County for the past few years pretty intensively.
You could imagine if Detroit and Wayne County were to spend that delinquent tax surplus money differently, you might be able to fund incredible citywide programs to eliminate blight, keep people in their houses better.
So in Wayne County especially, they've leaned very heavily on revenue from the delinquent tax revolving fund to boost their county's general fund. Some counties like Genesee County actually do what Jerry Paffendorf just mentioned, which is use some of that money for purposes related to tax foreclosure, like alleviating blight. But for most counties, I would say they're not using that money to do that.
Yeah, it's not hard to see how people would get into a spiral of debt with all this. Let's get back to the Raffaele lawsuit. What are the implications here if the plaintiffs win?
Well, the government argues there are some pretty big implications for the entire way that Michigan does tax foreclosure. They make the argument that that since the government would have to return any surpluses, auction surpluses to any property owner, they're going to have to do it for people, not just, you know, struggling homeowners who really live in their homes and struggle to pay their taxes, but people who truly abandoned properties or irresponsible kind of slum landlords or properties owned by speculators. And then there's also the issue of these complementary class action lawsuits that are going on by people who were in this situation, whose home sold at auction for more than they owed in taxes, and they want the government to return that money to them. And if the Supreme Court rules in Raffaele's favor, then they argue they could end up local governments could end up having to return as much as $2 billion to these property owners, which would obviously be a huge chunk of change. Dan Kildee is a Michigan congressman, and he's also the former Genesee County treasurer. And he argues that if Raffaele wins this lawsuit, it could just have some devastating impacts on local governments.
We would go back to the circumstance where the government takes the responsibility for all the losses that come from tax foreclosure, all the upside down costs that come with the 95% of the property that have no equity at all.
Obviously, some pretty big implications here if Raffaele does win this lawsuit.
Sarah, thanks for your work on this.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. If you missed her feature earlier this week, you can hear it or read the article at michiganradio.org. We'd like to bring in someone who knows a lot about preventing worst-case scenarios for property owners. Michelle Oberholzer is Director of Tax Foreclosure Prevention for United Community Housing Coalition. Michelle, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much.
What recourse do homeowners currently have if they're looking at a foreclosure?
That's a good question. My job and those people on my team, we spend our days counseling people, giving them step-by-step instructions. And there are some solutions available to people. Most of them require payment at some level. And so it's about making sure that when you pay, that the money you spend actually stops the foreclosure, that hopefully you can enter into a payment plan that is affordable to you. It usually comes with juggling the back taxes that are owing to the county with new taxes that are coming out from the city. And we're really reliant on the state laws, which dictate so much of the things that surround tax foreclosure here. So we have one low interest or lower interest payment plan available. That's the IRSPA plan that you was mentioned in your interview with Sarah Swick, where we heard that, yes, many people unfortunately owe more now than they did when they got on the plan. That's currently the best available plan. We would love to be able to refer people to get step forward assistance, Those are remaining hardest hit funds that are held by MSHDA. And unfortunately, even though we have seen tens of thousands of homeowners lose equity, lose their ownership due to foreclosure over these past 10 years, those dollars still remain with the state unspent in large part to avoid foreclosure. So that's not really a real solution for people. And here in Detroit, we have a partnership with the city and United Community Housing Coalition, where if you are a resident of a foreclosed home, you may be able to buy back the home that you live in before the auction. And that is through something called the Make It Home program. So there are some solutions available to people, but none of them come with guarantees. And unfortunately, many people continue to lose their homes and many have lost their homes.
There was a principle in play at this case that Sarah mentioned that I wanted to ask you about. And that's the sort of tacit understanding that if someone is going through the process for this 3-year period that's outlined, that they are assumed to be giving up their home, basically allowing the county to take it. Would you say that that is the state of mind that you find property owners in when you're working with them?
That's a good question. I certainly don't believe that people want to give up or wish to lose their homes. If there is resignation, it comes from a lack of access to actual solutions, a lack of clarity about the timeline, about the complete loss that will precipitate when the house is foreclosed. But a lot of people do have a sense, unfortunately, of despair. And most of my job, fortunately, doesn't involve telling people that it's too late. But for the woman whose story is profiled in Sarah Swick's piece, that was basically the case for her. I met her and I said, I wish I had met you 6 months ago. And this is a woman who really exemplifies the lawsuit that we're speaking about here, because she owed approximately $9,000 in property taxes. By the way, that includes the 18% interest. It includes the fees. So the base tax amount that she owed maybe have been about $5,000. She owed a total of $10,000 at the time of the foreclosure. And we knew that her home was worth more than that. And the way that the law is written, you know, you can look at the Wayne County Treasurer website. They have a timeline. April 1st, owner loses all ownership rights. All of her equity was eliminated when the house went into tax foreclosure. And so even though her house sold for over $40,000, as we predicted it would, the difference between her debt and the profit made by the county was not shared with her in any way. She was evicted around Thanksgiving and is now homeless. She could have had $30,000. You know, you could buy a house with that money, and the county could still have been made whole, including interest and fees, but that's just not the way the law is written. And this is completely different, by the way, from how other foreclosures are handled. If you have a bank foreclosure, you owe $50,000 on your home. If when the bank sells it, they sell it for more than what you're owed, what you owed, then you get the remainder. Mm-hmm. And I think for many people who are maybe not low income, many of our lawmakers, people at a different rung of society, it is shocking to them when they do realize, no, this is what we've been doing to low income homeowners. We basically penalize them for taking care of their home, regardless of the debt. Whether they owe a dollar or $10,000, if their house is foreclosed, they lose 100% of their equity.
What do you think could be done to simplify the timeline for homeowners who are behind on their taxes, to sort of just put the future ahead of them?
This is so inherently confusing to folks. Just to give one example of why it's confusing, if you owe taxes right now for 2018, in about a month, you're going to receive a forfeiture notice. And all that really means is that a $200 fee will be added to your debt, and it's basically a precursor to a later foreclosure. But that's not intuitive. It's not understandable. So if then, a year later, you get another thing that says you're going to be foreclosed, well, you didn't lose your home a year ago, so why is this going to be any different? It's very unclear what exactly the timeline is, what exactly the loss is, what exactly the debt is, and how much needs to be paid to satisfy the debt. So to answer your question, I mean, we could simplify this process a lot if we eliminated the tax collection in the county and kept everything with the city. At least then we would have one entity. We could improve our notice to actually tell people about exemptions they qualify for, to include the timeline and what the definitions are. This is how much you owe. This is how much you pay to stop the foreclosure, even if it's not the full amount. Those basic details are not being given, and they're the reason why my job exists, unfortunately, which is to fill the gaps in understanding and to try to make it so that no one loses their home for lack of information.
The investigation that the Detroit News published a week or so ago showed that the city has collected hundreds of millions of dollars in property taxes beyond what homes were truly valued at. And if folks missed this, we've got some past episodes of Stateside where you can catch up on that story. And meanwhile, many of the people lost their homes due to an inability to pay their property taxes, which again reflected values far beyond what their homes were actually worth. Just briefly, do you think there's a civil suit awaiting the city for this?
Well, there has already been a lawsuit. The ACLU sued the city of Detroit regarding excessive assessments, and that was thrown out of court. And my understanding of the reasoning that Judge Colombo gave was that there is already a process. There's already a due process where you can challenge your assessment. Now, for those of us in the property tax foreclosure cycle in that world, we know that the way that you are given an opportunity to challenge your assessment is in, you know, size 8 font in a 2-week window after you get your assessment in January. And it's not at all designed for mass reassessment or mass overassessment. So I didn't agree with the judge's findings. I don't know if there will be another lawsuit, but I do think that we are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the system that we've created. And, you know, this lawsuit is another piece of it. The article about overassessments just put a number on something that we've really known for years. We also know that many people who were eligible for tax exemptions, regardless of the property assessment, were not able to access those. And this current lawsuit that we're discussing today with the excessive takings, that is about, you know, do we actually profit additional to our interest and fees? Do we actually pit our government against its people and draw profit out of foreclosure? You know, these are all parts of the issue that I think are making us uncomfortable. And in response to Kildee's comments, so I want to say a couple things about that. It is true that if one home is worth more than its debt and the government essentially makes a profit off of that, for that home, there may be many others that have less equity and are going to sell for less in the auction than their debt. So his argument may be that we need these few ones that make a profit to cover the losses on the other properties. I would just say that's not at all similar to how, again, bank foreclosure, other types of debts are paid. But I do understand that there is a crisis of government funding here that's underlying all of this. But whenever we say this would be so difficult to untangle, that alone cannot be the rationale for us not to fix it. Basically, we're saying we've done so much injustice that to make it right would be very difficult. And that alone is speaking to the need for us to finally stop increasing the harm and try again to make up for the harm that we've caused others.
Michelle, thanks for talking with us about this today.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Oberholzer works for United Community Housing Coalition as Director of Tax Foreclosure Prevention. Once again, if you need to catch up on Sarah Swick's feature about foreclosures and how they play out at auction, you can find it at michiganradio.org. Attention, star watchers. Dr. T.K. Lawless Park in Michigan's own Cass County has been designated a dark sky park by the International Dark Sky Association. This is only the second place in Michigan designated as a dark sky park. Cass County Parks board member Robert Parrish led the effort to get the designation. He says that the night sky holds sentimental value for him.
My father loved looking at the night sky. He was a longtime member of the United States Navy, and he would relate to me when I was a boy the stories of how beautiful the night sky was from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Parrish says that saving dark skies for future Michiganders is important.
Whether you believe humans are on Earth because of some intelligent design or just by science happenstance, we're all made of star stuff. And being able to look at a night sky uninhibited by light pollution allows us to look at our origins.
An official celebration for the designation will be happening this spring, April 24th through the 26th. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.